I'm Casey Haskins.
And I'm Philippe Cousteau.
And we met for the first time about, what, a half hour ago?
Yeah.
And so this is one of those, we tried to coordinate it by email things, and
we did talk on the phone before.
We did talk 2 days ago on the phone. So we have a very simple plan, which is that we'll each explain in 1 minute our backgrounds and tell a story, and then we'll go where you guys want to go. It's a conversation, okay? Because that's a hard plan to screw up, and it's one that you can do without knowing your partner, I think.
I warned Casey I needed to be very simple for me to, be able to do it, so.
So I am probably the biggest outlier here in that I have no background whatsoever in foundations or in philanthropy or whatever. I was brought in, my background is military. I spent 30 years in the Army, retired last year. So I've had actually a fair amount of experience on the other end in a disaster area of one sort or another, and trying to help the various people who show up to help, trying to make it so that that actually works together and accomplishes something more. And so that's, in the last 15 years or so, I accidentally became something of a turnaround specialist in the Army. So they would send me to places where they really wanted to change it and make things work differently. And Peter Sims over there, who's our final speaker, he and I are partners in a new business that's designed to help large organizations learn to become innovative, taking off where our last speaker left. So if we're gonna do any of this, I'm really more of a practical guy. So it's all about, okay, great, how do you do it? What do you look at? What gets in the way? How do you do it? So that's really more naturally where I would like to go. But like I said, we'll go anywhere. Philippe, you wanna introduce yourself and then we'll start with the story?
Sure. So my name's Philippe Cousteau, and I guess my connection to the conference comes through Vicky Sproul. She is a friend of mine, and a CEO of Ocean Conservancy invited me to join the board of directors of Ocean Conservancy, which I still serve, which she was CEO of for several years. And my work is in conservation, social environmental conservation, sustainability. My personal mission is to help people understand the power they have to change the world. And that manifests itself in a lot of different ways. So I do lots of different things, right? So although pursuing that general goal, I run a nonprofit, Earth Echo International. We're rapidly becoming, we are certainly one of, rapidly becoming the leading youth environmental education service learning group in the country. We focus on middle and high school kids and empower youth to get engaged in solving problems in their communities with respect to the health of the environment. I am a special correspondent for CNN, so I have a series on CNN International that doesn't air that much domestically, but all over the rest of the world, called Going Green, and we cover social and environmental issues around the world. I also do other news programs and specials and things like that for CNN. I just launched, in partnership with an investment company, a sustainable investment fund, an exchange-traded fund on the New York Stock Exchange about 6 months ago, with a correlating foundation that is a new take on impact investing. And I do various other sundry different speaking and have a consulting company, and we do lots of different projects around the world around against sustainability, education, storytelling, et cetera. So that's what I'm here to talk about. I'll hand it back to Casey to share a story, and then I'll share a story, and then we'll talk.
I've kind of changed what I was going to say based off what I thought was a very good set of stories, the last one, and how everyone agrees we want to stop homelessness and we actually end up perpetuating homelessness. And I've seen this a lot. You've seen it a lot too. It's a very common thing. And the question is less why does that happen, but instead how do you get out of that and how do you get to where you want to go? I was, it was in 2002. And I had been very briefly in Afghanistan early on. And then I was supposedly on a fellowship at Queen's University in Canada. So I returned briefly to Canada and then got one of those emails, hot, 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 sorry, you're leaving. And you're... So initially I went to Bosnia, and it was kind of cool. The problem that we had was when the wall came down at the end of the Cold War, great danger. No one saw that coming the way it came. Everyone always thought it would be cataclysmic collapse. But great danger that the Eastern European countries rapidly become upset with the fact they're not becoming rich and that everything doesn't work right away, and they become demoralized and they go back into being dictatorships or something worse. So no one really had a plan. No one knew how to solve this. Some very clever people just started throwing things at the problem. No clue what's going to work, just throw people at it. And the NATO chief, the head of the Supreme Allied Commander Europe, said, get people in there, here's money, you don't have a lot of rules, help them, your goal is to help them become compatible with NATO, with an eye toward joining NATO in the future. NATO's been fantastic, best thing that ever happened in European history, at stopping wars. They may not be all that great at fighting, but France and Germany have not shot at each other in a very long time and are not going to, and NATO has been a key part of stopping everyone. As the joke went, the original construct of NATO was to keep America in, keep the Russians out, and prevent France and Germany from shooting at each other. It's been fantastically successful. So if we could get Hungary and Poland and Czechoslovakia, which rapidly broke into two, to join, to be on the path to joining NATO, then we would be pretty sure that they wouldn't fall. European Union was doing this. Lots of other people were doing it. So there was this program, and as programs do, it had become very ossified. It ended up with a book of rules that thick and a process that took a year. Also, as programs do, long after its purpose had ceased, the program continued to go. And I mean, they had actually joined NATO and our first world, and they're still getting the things that the program gave away and still very reluctant to be weaned from it. I really had only had a little bit of experience with it, but then Bosnia happened, NATO struggled with that, the war had ended, come and gone. Now, 6 years after the end of the Bosnian Civil War, which didn't really end, we just really pushed the pause button. So you still have the warring sides staring at each other, ready to go, and our job is to lower that. And an opportunity came up, and another very smart Supreme Allied Commander said, we're going to take this program in and try, see if that helps at all in Bosnia. He threw every program he had, as did the Secretary of State, into Bosnia. Again, the object is stop it from going to war. So my part, of course, is the Army. I'm supposed to focus on the Army. The program, which had all these rules, was horrible. I mean, you have to go coordinate with the Ministry of Defense, you have to agree what they want a year from now, you have to coordinate to deliver all that. You know, it's basically like a travel agency kind of model. But in Bosnia, there is no Ministry of Defense. There's not a government. There's three competing governments. They don't know what they want. They won't agree to all come together. So there's all these rules, and they spent 3 days explaining them to me, and then the general called me in and said, yeah, you don't have to do that. You have a lot of money, but you better get results. Cool, great, great. So I went to Bosnia and just basically looked around. And the problem I started with first was landmines. Downtown Sarajevo, for instance, was one of the most densely mined spots on the planet Earth. And I don't think I ever went more than 4 days without some bird landing on a mine and blowing itself up. And every Friday at 3 o'clock, the mines they had found that week all went up. And that was important because the people in Sarajevo now kind of react in a bad way when there's random explosions. They're conditioned to respond. And so if you do it at a time when they know it's coming, then they don't react as badly. But here again, now this is 6 years since the war has ended. It's probably 4 years since we've started demining operations. And it turns out, come on in, Lee. It turns out that we're not making a lot of progress. And why is that? Well, A, there's about 20 different organizations involved in this. B, many of them have competing plans. C, their budget depends on, to a degree, not solving this problem, or solving it, but making it last decades. So we're on track to have the mines gone from Sarajevo in the year 2060 at that current rate. Not a particularly great way of going. And so again, now no one knows who I am. I can dress however I want. I have an office in the embassy. They wear a coat and tie, so I never wear a coat and tie in the embassy. And then I have another office out at the NATO headquarters. They wear uniforms, so I never wear a uniform when I go there. And so people will listen to me, because I have a lot of money, and then they don't know what rules I have. There were rules, but I didn't tell anyone what they were. So they would listen to me, and I could go talk to different people. And what it really came down to, what happened on this, is eventually I rented a hotel. You have to rent an entire hotel because the Serbs, the Croats, and the Bosniaks, someone has to travel because they live in different places, and it's not like going from here to San Francisco. It takes some time to get there. And they have to stay at night, and they can't live among the population. So you have to bring them all to one place. So I rented a hotel and set up this conference and brought in everyone, invited anyone I could think of who might remotely have anything to do with the mines. And you walk in Sarajevo, it's a small city. It's small. But virtually everyone you meet is a general or a minister because they have like more government per capita than any other place I've ever been. And so everyone's something. So one of the things we did was this. I can't solve the protocol problem, folks. And it'll start the war again if I try to say, so just grab a chair. And we spent a whole day just arguing about what the problem was. And of course, there's people who say the problem is the mines in this field. And there's people who say we need more dogs. And there's people who, you know, because dogs can sniff the mines. And I have no idea what the problem is. But to me, the problem is that we're not doing this. And then we took a break, had a dinner, and then we came back. And what we did was accidental, and it was me settling for what I could get, but it turned out to be brilliantly lucky. We stopped focusing on how we were going to do anything, and all we tried to do was agree on what are we trying to accomplish. Not specifically get rid of the mines. But what will success look like? When will we be done? And we came up with six things that we had to do. We had to identify groups that could help us get rid of the mines. Bosnia, if you've ever been there, it's not a flat country, and it's that way because it's seismically active. It moves. So the mines, you know, with rain and weather and earthquakes and all that, the mines, A, no one really knew where they were put in the ground, because these were not professional armies that keep track of where they put them. These are guys slipping out at night and just putting mines in. So A, they don't know where they used to be. B, they've moved since. And so there's a problem. So one of the things became find the mines. One of the ways of doing that turned out to be you go ask the kids, where do the cows blow up? Kids know where the cows blow up. Where the cows blow up tends to be where the mines are. And that gave us our best starting map. You know, there's all these high-tech things. But what we did was we didn't try to agree on a plan. We agreed on what the outcomes would be, the whole set of outcomes. What happened almost accidentally was we shifted what people were passionate about. Because most of the people in the room were people like you, and they're passionate about doing a good thing. But the problem is you kind of get locked in on what your passion is. You need passion to do anything, but the passion kind of makes you have tunnel vision. And it's hard to have an argument in a couple of languages simultaneously for 2 days. When you wrestle with a hard problem, you automatically kind of get passionate about it. You get wedded to it. And what happened was that we switched the passion from, I'm running this dog training school and I need you to give me more money for my dog training school, to we need to find the mines. And the room kind of owned those outcomes. And that allowed us to create a new group that they all got to be represented on that did nothing but track how are we doing. There were no good guys, no bad guys, really everyone's a bad guy, but no moral judgments on it, just we have this problem, we have mines, we don't know where they are, we don't want mines, how do we get rid of them? And we locked everyone on to agreeing that we're trying to accomplish these things. And then every 2 months we got together and assessed where we were on all of these. And we had some really great ideas that turned out not to work at all. We had some others that everyone's like, okay, humor her, we'll do it. Brilliant. It started working, not always the way she thought it would, but we'll take them. We don't care. But by locking ourselves on what we were trying to accomplish rather than how we were going to accomplish it, it shifted the entire conversation. It caused us we pushed the group in one direction by focusing on how we're going to do it. Then we pulled them in the same direction by measuring it. In a simple law of human nature, people train to the test, always. What gets measured gets done. What doesn't get measured may get done, but it's an uphill fight and it's like Sisyphus. As soon as you stop pushing the rock rolls back down. So we started measuring the results. Brilliant. When I left, we were 5 years away from getting rid of all the significant minefields. No more resources, no more money, no central planner, because they didn't all work for anyone. Many of them are people like you, foundations. They don't have a boss that can, I can't tell them pay for this dog training school. We just merely got them to be part of agreeing on what needed to be done. They saw what was working, what didn't, and it helped gravitate people. Some agreed, not. No more resources, simply changing coordination and shifting the passions to achieving these outcomes rather than following a particular path. And large parts of Bosnia are now essentially free of mines for all practical purposes. Something that the people in the room did merely by looking at it a little bit differently and not thinking that they could, stopping believing that they could predict exactly what the right answer was. So that's the story that I chose to tell as a result of the predecessor, and we'll come back and talk about whatever. Now, Philippe's going to talk about something from a totally different point of view.
So I'll be brief. I one story. So my grandfather was Jacques Cousteau, and for anyone in here who doesn't know who he was or what he did, 40, 50 years he traveled around the world. He co-invented the scuba tank, the aqualung, and he was a global leader in conservation. So certainly someone that influenced me growing up a lot in what I do today. My grandfather always told me growing up, you know, we live in a connected world. And being somebody who had so many wonderful experiences with him, I definitely believed what he had to say. But it wasn't until I saw it myself with my own eyes in Papua New Guinea. I was 16 years old and we went up there to do some research, not with my grandfather, but with another folks we know. And I remember I was up in the highlands, one of the most remote parts of the entire world. The Huli tribesmen live there. They don't have plumbing and electricity. They live in grass huts, hunt with spears and bow and arrow, etc. And I remember walking down a dusty road, Again, very primitive technologically. Rich culture, but technologically primitive. And there was a group of holy tribesmen walking towards me, and they were wearing grass skirts and barefoot and bare-chested and had their birds of paradise feathers and had their weapons, and you know they were hunting in the forest. And an older group of gentlemen were walking towards me, and there were a couple young guys in the back. And I remember, still to this day, it was a hot, sunny day, dusty road, in the jungle, surrounded by jungle, and a couple of the men at the back of the group had Lakers t-shirts on. Still grass skirts, bow and arrows in the works. And here I was thinking to myself, in the most remote part of the entire world, somehow these guys had Lakers t-shirts. And there was my grandfather ringing true in the back of my mind, we are all connected, we are all connected. And that stuck with me. And he was a great innovator. And I also remember, the 30s, my grandfather's dream was to be, a lot of people don't know this, to be in the Naval Aviation Program. He wanted to fly, he wanted to go up. They had no passion or knowledge or care about the oceans. Not really anybody did. The only things that we knew at the time were, you know, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. The only way we had to explore the ocean were those big hard helmets clomping around on the bottom, or pearl divers might go down and, with homemade masks to see things. And we knew what was in the ocean just from what we pulled in our nets. And unfortunately, my grandfather was driving, or perhaps fortunately, I could call this maybe the most fortuitous car accident in history, because he was driving on a windy road in southern France to visit my grandmother, and he had a car accident, and he broke his back. And at first, they didn't even know if he'd be able to walk again, but he was able to rehabilitate himself enough to be able to walk, and he was prescribed by the doctors, this is the early 40s, to swim in the Mediterranean Ocean every day as a means of rehabilitation. And a man named Philippe Taillez, his captain in the Navy, gave my grandfather a pair of homemade goggles. Again, not something you just go down to the store and buy. You had to make them yourself. Old rubber from tires and ground down glass and a strap. And he started swimming and looking down to see what he was swimming above every day. And a passion was born, and he turned this terrible life tragedy of not being able to fly into a journey of discovery. He turned something, a terrible disaster, into a positive. And that curiosity of seeing these things underwater then led him on his life's journey to change the world. And so those were always very important for me. He was a great innovator. He always tried to see the world in a different way, always tried to question the world around him, bless you. And as I grew up and got older and was in university and trying to look and find my own way in life, and certainly inspired by the legacy of my father and my grandfather, we started down the road of doing kind of your typical nonprofits, you know, ocean conservation work, or some science and some research, and we started a nonprofit up, my sister and I, struggling as we went along. So my grandfather died at seven. I was 17, and great legacy. He was a great man, but we didn't inherit anything. We had to go on our own way. So we built it all up from scratch. We live in a little hut, literally, down on the beach in Florida, where we had our offices out of Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institution for a few years. They were kind enough to give us office space there. But we just saw that we weren't really having the kind of impact that we wanted to have. And so what we started to do was start to question the world around us and question what we were doing and how we were doing it. And I didn't just want to be another NGO that's doing our work because that's just what everybody else is doing. We really wanted to do something different, not reinvent the wheel, and challenge the status quo. And so what we started to realize is that, as a friend of mine said at an event for the 40th anniversary of the Clean Water Act, when we talk about the environment, we don't have a technological problem, we don't have a scientific problem, we have a political problem, right? So I reverse engineered that, and I said, okay, it's not just a political problem, that means we have a constituent problem, okay? And what is the single best way to begin then to help enlist and create and build on a social movement? Traditionally, NGOs in the environmental space, and I'm on the board or work with a lot of them, the great groups that do a lot of great work, have very little, if any, youth strategy whatsoever. We're still committed to the idea, and we did it. We did public service announcements, and we did documentaries. But what we started to realize was, looking at measurables, it wasn't achieving the impact that we wanted to achieve. And the last time I can't remember the last time I heard an adult say, wow, I saw a billboard, I watched a public service announcement, and it totally changed my mind. I am so convinced now of something that I completely disagreed with before, thanks to that 30-second ad. And I've never heard that, actually. So we started to think, all right, let's think differently. And a lot of people still throw a lot of money at that those types of programs. And again, we looked at the landscape where Wildlife Fund and Ocean Conservancy and all these groups, and that's not their mission to set out to do youth, but they had no youth strategy, essentially. Still many of them do not. So we started focusing on education. We started focusing on service learning. And then we started to build relationships with folks. We'd moved to DC at the time that were a few blocks away. And we started to say, you know, we're also siloed. We should maybe be talking to some other groups. And so we started talking to groups that do psychology. We started talking to groups that understand behavioral modification, as Orwellian as that sounds. We started talking to NGOs, education groups, distribution organizations, National Science Teacher Association, and others that weren't in the environmental space, but if we wanted to target kids that we needed to partner with and build our network with. And so it's been a great success for us as we've started to build those networks, understand where there's need, where we can fill and not reinvent the wheel, and that's what Earth Echo's done. And then the second piece of what I do, of the three or four or five things that we do, in the investment space, was 2008. I was, the height of the financial crisis. We're a grant-seeking organization at Earth Echo. Raising money is not easy. I hate it. And it's the hardest part of my job, for sure. Some people love raising money. I do not. So I was lamenting this to a friend of mine over drinks in New York. And I have a degree in history, by the way, from the University of St. Andrews. I don't even, at the time, own stocks, know anything about financial markets to save my life. I finished Algebra 2 in high school, and then I was like, I'm done with math. So always a little daunting and scary for me, financial markets, and I don't understand anything about it. So in New York, my friend said, do you ever think about financial markets? And I said, no, I don't know the first thing. Fast forward 4 years, 2 years of building relationships and starting to ask, because it planted a seed in my mind. I said, is there an opportunity here? We launched a fund and a foundation. It's a totally different model for finding ways to leverage impact investing and create new philanthropic wealth. So basically what we looked at is, I said, you know, $300 billion is roughly the annual charitable giving in the United States. And that's a mature market. It's not like it's going to be exploding anytime soon. It's not going to be growing exponentially. Financial markets represent $25 trillion in the US. It's a lot of money. Impact investing is $3 trillion and rising. So as I looked at financial markets and I started to try and think to myself, where are we going to find new sources of dollars to start putting against these types of problems? From pension funds to investments to foundations that have a bunch of money in the bank, endowments, et cetera, there's a lot of money that's sitting out there that we could be directing towards solving these problems. Not to replace philanthropy, but to enhance philanthropy. And that is a big area for growth. So we launched an ETF, and I chose an ETF because I wanted something that anybody could invest in through E-Trade. I bought my shares on E-Trade. On the New York Stock Exchange, under the ticker symbol GIVE, where we got the money managers to give a percentage of their management fee to put into a charitable foundation. Because I didn't want to just create an impact investing tool. I wanted to create new philanthropic wealth as well. And so for me, that was another way of looking and trying to, as my grandfather said, we're all connected. We need to look for different solutions to the same old, age-old problems. As an environmental movement, if we really want to change that constituent problem, we need to focus on youth. I firmly believe that because I hear all the time parents coming up to me and saying, my kids came home today and they would not leave me alone to start recycling or to start a clean energy thing or to compost. Or you want to talk about parents changing their behavior? PSA doesn't do it. Their kids coming home every day does it, whether they agree with it or not. Try and have a moral argument with a 13-year-old, and you are going to lose. Don't even waste your time. So for us, because you still talk to a lot of big foundations, big NGOs, and they go, oh, that's nice, kids, you're doing education, that's nice, that's nice. You know, it's like a 20-year payback. And what they are failing to understand is that the lever to change behavior today is kids, and you're equipping them with the knowledge so that they become more responsible citizens. You're getting a double return on that investment. It's not just something that's nice that's going to happen down the road. And the data backs all that up. Smoking cessation, seatbelt campaigns, successful because they targeted youth and education. So from always the words of my grandfather and my legacy, and I've gone too long, echoing in my mind, think differently, always question the world around you, and understand that we're all connected. Those are my two personal experiences that have led me to do what I do. So
I jump in. The strategy in Bosnia,
again, our goal was not to make them a, we're not trying to turn Bosnia into Switzerland. We would like eventually for them to be able to go that path. But it was, don't let the war resume. Strategy was simple. Don't allow the old men who fought the war to do it again, and then train the young people in a different way. So we would devote most of our effort to the 20 to 30 year olds, because we could only touch them once they're professionals, to the 20 to 30 year olds, and we would give them hard problems to solve together, and we'd make teams where they were all represented. So they would be arguing passionately about the right approach, but nothing at all. And then we had, I had the ambassador host a reception for them, and it was wonderful. They're all mingling, they're all friends, they're all exchanging emails with each other. And then the bus shows up with the generals and the ministers, and damned if it was like someone turned on a magnet. Suddenly all the Bosniaks went in this room, all the Serbs went in that room, all the Croats went in that room, and they will not be seen talking to each other. So the goal is, don't let those guys ruin it. Hold on until the kids grow up enough that they can change it. That's the same thing you're doing. Stop the people who caused the problem from causing any more problem, and train the people who will eventually maybe fix it. That's the approach. Okay, at this point, I think we can go any of a number of directions. So let's follow our plan, and who wants to kick it off, or ask a question, or where do we want this session to go?
Hello, Heidi Ronberry, the Ronberry Foundation. Casey, something that you said that I thought was really interesting, we're guilty of it. I don't know how many of you will admit to it, but we have complex problems in the world, and we want to find this one solution to fix it all. But what I appreciate you saying is that you guys weren't necessarily stuck on what is that one solution. Let's avoid the how, which is, and any of you that are involved with engineering, you know, we marketing people walk in and say like, oh, this is what it has to do. Like, let the engineers figure it out. And on a quick aside, I don't know how many of you have ever done the marshmallow test. This is, okay. So I don't know if I want to give it away or not, but essentially, but yeah, I won't tell you what it is, but the conclusion is that kindergartners will kick the butts of all MBA grads because school children will trial. They don't get obsessed with what the business plan must be and what the outcome will be based on a good, successful business plan. And in that trial period, they succeed before the MBA graduates. So.
Well, it's critical thinking, right? So not everything that we do in education, the service learning model is saying, identify a problem that you care about. So we're not gonna top down and say, you have to do a beach cleanup, or you have to do a clean energy program in your school. You have to grow a garden, or you have to do anything like that. It's nothing so prescriptive as that. It's saying, find something you're passionate about, design a solution, and implement that solution. And what are the measurables? How do you connect to those? You know, except that there's more to it, but how do you provide resources for educators? One of the things that we found, and we were guilty of, And I'm a big believer in admitting mistakes and facing up to those mistakes, is we created curriculum. And a lot of NGOs spent a lot of money creating curriculum, never actually going and talking to the teachers that the curriculum is designed for, listening to what the teachers actually need. Instead, we come to the table with well-meaning ideas and say, we know, let's create more curriculum for educators that's be teaching the way we think they should be teaching. Well, as soon as you talk to a couple teachers, you realize that's stupid. Because they've got principals breathing down their necks, they have standards they have to teach you, and what they need is help teaching what they have to do already. That's why Discovery Education, which is one of our partners, is so successful. We're in 26, we have access to 1 million teachers and 26 million middle and high school students across the country because it's curriculum enhancement. So we made mistakes, nobody's using it. Why isn't anybody downloading our great curriculum online? Well, maybe we should talk to some teachers and find out. And wow, brilliant, amazing, wow, they tell us. That's not what we need. And we said, wow. And I still look at a lot of NGOs that dwarf us in size and still make those same mistakes because they're just not even going and talking to their end users. They're not willing to think differently.
I want to, at the risk of perhaps screwing this up, I don't want to turn this into a class, but there's a problem that we didn't really talk about in that opening session. And everyone kind of knows this, but we have this ability of compartmentalizing and agreeing with something at the moment, and it still doesn't quite feel right to us, because later in different circumstances, we don't think the same things. There's a lot of things we know that just aren't true. Like all of you, whether you've ever taken economics or not, you know that supply and demand go like that, right? The more demand there is, the higher the price, right? And the more supply there is, then the price goes down. Everyone knows that, everyone believes that, that's the fundamental rule, except when it's not true. And I'll give you two examples when it's not true. One is a network, so a utility, a network. A telephone has very limited value if there's only two people on the phone, who have a phone. I mean, I can call Peter. That's a walkie-talkie. Not very useful. Yeah, it's some useful, but not very much. The more people who have telephones, though, the more useful this thing becomes. So you increase supply, you actually increase the price. You increase the value of it. Facebook is like that. Okay, you could probably invent something better than Facebook. Arguably, others have. Doesn't matter. Facebook's worth more because it has, you know, half the population of the planet is on Facebook. So you can connect to almost everyone you want to on Facebook, whereas you can't with Google. That's one. Another one is luxury items. Okay? That one has an interesting curve, but it's not the normal supply and demand. If there's only one or two, they're not worth as much because you want, there has to be enough. The sweet spot where value is maximized is when there's enough for everyone to recognize it, but not enough that everyone can have it. But if there's only one of these in the world and I have it, no one knows, what good is that? I mean, you know, if you're wearing designer shoes. Half of the fun of having designer shoes is having everyone else recognize that you're wearing designer shoes. So the price actually goes up as they make more, unless you can buy them in the Kmart. And then the price. So we know this, we see it all the time. You've all driven past, probably today, a corner where there's a gas price on one side of the intersection and a different gas price on the other. By economic law, that should not happen. But it happens every day in every city. So we know this to be true, but it's not true, and it doesn't trouble us. One of the things we're talking about is very similar to this. There's different kinds of systems, and they behave differently, and the way we have to solve them is very different. And so I hate to go off on a little bit of a class, but there are four kinds of systems. This is physics, but it's still not taught very much. There's simple, there's chaotic, which, despite the fact that we talk about it a lot, we hardly ever do anything with it. You can't solve a chaotic problem because it doesn't sit still long enough to understand it, let alone solve it. If you think of the rapids in a whitewater rafting expedition, that's a chaotic. And the way you handle that is exactly the right way. You prepare ahead of time, you hold on when you're in there, and then you try to sort it out quickly as you can when you emerge from the other side. That's chaotic. Simple is a system in which there's either one right answer or one clearly best answer. Not a problem how you solve it, because any method will work, because it's simple. But then there's two more, and this is where we have a problem. Complicated and complex. Now, this is a problem because we think of those as synonyms, and in fact, in our minds, we approach them both the same way. And this gets at what Heidi was talking about and what we said before. And the reason why systems thinking is hard is because frequently it's not the appropriate thing. If you think about matter, there's also physics has four kinds of matter. There's gas, there's plasma, we won't worry about them. Liquid and solid. We intuitively are good at spotting the difference. So no one confuses ice with water. Right? Every little kid can immediately tell the difference. You've never seen anyone strap on ice skates to go swimming in the Mediterranean. No one would make that mistake. You've never seen anyone put on a scuba gear to go play hockey. We have no problem distinguishing between those. They're different problems, so there's different solutions. Will these behave just as differently
as ice and water, but we don't have the chip in our head that lets us distinguish between them. So we're all intuitively, we're good at this one. Cause leads to effect, predictably. It's deterministic, we can figure it out. It's complicated, there's not one best answer, there's many possible answers. Your car is a good example of a complicated problem. There's a lot of ways you could design the car, but once you've designed it, everything fits together, and essentially you push on the gas pedal and this sequence of events occurs and it makes the wheels go faster, right? Every time, unless it breaks. The weather is a good example of a complex system. The weather person comes on TV and says 70% chance of rain today. She is correct. 70% of the time she says that, it rains. 30% of the time, it does not. The question is today one of the 70 or one of the 30? The thing is, she can't tell you in advance. No one can. No one will ever be able to. We get better models, we may be able to go 7 days in the future instead of five like we can do. She may someday be able to say 72.3% chance of rain today, but she'll never be able to tell you. And the reason is because if you put the exact same things in the exact same situation, sometimes it unfolds like that, sometimes it unfolds like that. So it's a probabilistic outcome, different approach. Like David was saying, things may take a while before you see the downstream consequences. Another complex system is the tectonic plates of the world. We can statistically predict with fabulous accuracy the magnitude and number of earthquakes on the planet Earth. And we'll get it right. I mean, you could make a lot of money if you could find someone dumb enough to bet with you on it. The problem is that does no good at all. Is the one right out there going to go today? No clue. At best, I can give you a probabilistic curve. But does that help you? Do I buy the real estate or not? Can't tell you. I can tell you in aggregate how the whole system will work, but I can't tell you how a piece of it. Markets are complex systems. Your organizations, all these wicked problems are complex systems. The problem is that your mind automatically does complicated systems, and then we sent you to school for 16 or 20 years to teach you how to solve complicated problems, which is the thing you're already good at anyway, and we made you even better at it. But sometimes ice skates are what you want. So this conference, right, is a complicated problem. It would not do to go out and wing it and experiment. Okay, we have the opening session lined up and we have this hotel. We haven't laid on the rest of the hotel and we'll figure it out though. Come on to the opening session and then we'll experiment. We'll see if they'll rent us some other rooms. We'll see if we can find some people to come up and give talks. They don't do that. So for this kind of system, centralized planning with attention to all the details is precisely correct. Scheduling, engineering, that's how you solve that kind of problem. It's not that it's better or it's worse, that's how you solve that kind of problem. This kind of problem, that makes it worse. Your ice skates do not help you swim. They actually drag you down. So a different set of tools for a different category of problem. That's where we've gone wrong, is that we keep trying to apply these. Most of our problems are complex, but almost all of our methods for solving them are appropriate for complicated. And that's where we get into this bind, is that we have not taught people how to think through this. But it's not to say that you never use those tools. The people who built this building were very good at complicated problem solving. They're good, and thank God for it, because I don't want the roof falling on my head. And so, however, we then expect the people who set up the shops here to apply that same thing and come up with a business plan that looks like the architectural plan, even though we all know it's not going to work. But we can't go, say, throw that out and only focus on complex problem solving, because deep in your heart, you already know there's a lot of problems that this is perfectly appropriate for. When you go home and clean your house, it's a complicated problem. Many ways to do it. It's going to get worse before it gets better, but you have to It's something that you can centrally plan and figure out how you want to do it, and then that's the right way to do it. When you go into Bosnia and say, I got to figure out where the mines are and how to get rid of them, you can't centrally plan that. And even if you could, you can't. But even if you could, it wouldn't work, because none of the people involved cares what you say. They don't work for you. And you can't make them do that. So a different approach, different kind of problem. But I think it's important to point out, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. This is extraordinarily useful. All this stuff around us exists because we've learned to solve this. Okay, off the soapbox. Sorry.
Question? Another question? You got about 10 minutes or so.
I just wanted to make a comment. You talk about problems and things, and I've found that in working in China and Asia and so on, that for the most part you don't talk about problems. You talk about opportunities. Because if you talk about a problem, somebody made that problem and somebody's at fault. And it may be me or it may be you, and it starts out the conversation. Now, this is something different. You have a problem to, you know, a light system, and you want to do it. But if you're working in a lot of countries, deal with opportunities. Even if they're 1% and they need to be at 98%, make sure it's an opportunity to go up as sort of instead of a problem that needs to be, you know, you've caused a problem kind of approach. So it's just a different way of
very positive reinforcement, right? I mean, looking for positive opportunities as opposed to problems.
Exactly.
Well, it can even go work further, because if you're identifying a problem, then you are also challenging the particular person in the room, especially in Asia, to lose face.
Yeah, well, especially in Asia.
You've started out a situation, you've already made it bad if you don't say, we have an opportunity, because if you can identify who's caused the problem, then that person's lost face.
Peter, you want to grab that?
I thought about this question. I think it's a good point. Thank you. I'll just say comment briefly on this. Thank you guys both. Really insightful stories and comments. I think, Philippe, you said it's really important to be able to empathize with other people when you're framing what you're going to do about a problem. It's somebody's problem that you're trying to. People spend a lot of time in this room thinking about the needs of their stakeholders. And these are problems that stakeholders have. But you're right, I think entrepreneurs need to think in terms of opportunity and in getting people, other stakeholders engaged in that opportunity. And Casey, I would imagine you thought a lot about this in Bosnia, where you have a set of problems that need to be identified first, including with the various ethnic groups that are legitimate problems, but then you have to flip that framing as you're working towards a shared vision to get people excited about where you're going to go. So I think it's a really insightful point, but I think you need to be able to do both problems, frame problems, find problems, and then target towards the solution and opportunity.
How you frame the problem turns out to be hugely important too, and we all know this, but I'll give you an example that we're working on right now. If you ask the question, how do we teach our children better? You can come up with a range of answers to that. If you ask a different question though, how do we ensure that our children graduate able to do these things, knowing this stuff? You get a different range of answers, because it's no longer about, when I ran a department, a university department, that was my biggest challenge, was to stop the teachers from thinking of themselves as the teacher and make them instead the facilitator of learning from the students. I don't really care if he learned it from you. In fact, it'd be better if he didn't learn it from you. I care that we know that he or she knows it when they finish. Different problem. And how you frame that is very different. And I got that wrong a lot. That was kind of what we did wrong in Iraq when we went there, is how do we win the war rather than how do we get to a country that's like this, which is a very different approach. And so it's not just how you phrase it to the people, it's also you need to try different ways of asking the questions And you might find that you have different, that it's a different set of challenges.
Hi, I'm Sarah Stranahan, and I'm struck that your story that you told today and the story that was told during the plenary both involve taking institutions or individuals who normally are in a competitive relationship with each other or in conflict with each other and somehow getting them to work collectively toward a common goal. And it's, that seems to be a little bit of a theme. And I'm wondering, is that something that you're aware of? Like, it almost sounded like you were able to take all those divergent interests who tended to be in conflict with each other and get them to work as a team because they had all established goals that they had shared goals. And do you think that when groups of people have shared goals that they tend to organize themselves? Like, you don't even really have to organize them. They'll organize themselves because they're all trying to figure out, like a soccer team, the coach isn't saying, hey, you know, you better run up there and protect the goal because the other team is, you know, the player knows to go protect the goal. I mean, the coach may at halftime say, hey, next time I want you faster on that. But the player basically knows what the other players are doing, what the ball is doing is going to position themselves strategically for the team, right? Because they have a common goal, win the game. But is that something you would think about?
You want to take that? Or?
I mean, for us, it's one of the big challenges is, and one of the ways we've been successful is definitely finding folks and being willing to bring disparate groups together that all have a common goal. We find ourselves oftentimes is just the convening is important, right? So finding the right people in the room. Who needs, who isn't there, who needs to be there, and bringing them all together. And being able to then create a positive reinforcement structure for them. That's how we train dolphins, that's how we train dogs, that's how we train people. Long-term positive reinforcement, that's what we like. We all like to have positive reinforcement. And find ways to frame what we're all going after so that nobody feels threatened and people are willing to think differently and move forward together. And I think from an education perspective, why Urtheca's been successful in our programs and we're growing, starting to do programs internationally, programs in Spanish. We did a huge program at the State Department this summer in the World Expo in South Korea, representing the United States and our oceans and coasts and education. And I think it's because we've been able to bring people in the room with a common goal of a problem, but that we've been willing to be like, it's not just the usual characters, right? So always for us, I think we're successful when we're a little uncomfortable. Because it's so easy to fall into a rut and just keep doing the same thing. I always tell folks, I'm like, if you're doing the same thing today that you were doing 10 years ago, you are failing. We should be changing, thinking differently about how we're doing, whether it's technology, all the resources and tools and knowledge that exists out there. And a lot of NGOs are doing the same thing they were doing 40 years ago, the same types of campaigns, the same types of education, and that's not okay. You got to keep moving forward. If you're not keep pushing that boulder forward, it's going to slide back on you. And you can't even just stand in one place. You have to be moving forward, or you're going to lose ground.
Yeah, exactly. Three quick thoughts on that. One, occasionally there are people who you cannot get to work. I'll take the example that probably someone in this room works with women's reproductive rights. Right? There are people who will dedicate their lives to stopping you from succeeding because they think that's the right thing to do. There is no tent big enough to get them under it as part of the solution. That just won't happen. So you have to recognize it's not the norm. The Army tends to think it is, but it's usually most people aren't actively out to stop you. Most people are really trying to do the right thing as they see it. But sometimes there are people that have to be neutralized, excluded. So it's important to recognize that. It's not, no matter how much you would like to pretend, there are people who are going to try to stop you. So you have to be smart enough to make that distinction. Second thing is that, yes, it's absolutely critical to refocus the group on the problem and get them going. But it's not enough. There's two more things that are required. One, you have to find the impediments and remove them. So if we, and that's hard, because no one knows what they are. You know what a few of them are, and it turns out that when you fix those, there's more that we didn't know because no one had ever gotten that far. And they're not intentional. They weren't put there for that purpose. They were put there with the best of intentions in the world. For the example on the homeless one, it was how the funding went, right? Now, there was not a bad guy anywhere in that program. Everyone agrees, but to do the right thing, they had created a funding structure that inadvertently prevented the change. Someone had to identify that and then do the work of removing that impediment. And usually there's a lot of them, and it takes a while to find them and remove enough of them to allow the change. So that's important. It's not enough to just get the room. You then have to go find what it's blocking the progress and deal with it. And the third thing I would say is, again, we see what we expect to see. We see what we want to see. And so if you get agreement on the problem, that's great. But what you really need is to now pull by assessing it. You need to get the evidence, and you need to make it so that people are unemotionally not, and you can't let it be good guys and bad guys, or it was your short, you failed, you screwed this up, you should have done. No, they did everything right. It just didn't rain that day, right? So they did everything right. Let's just agree unemotionally that this, we made some progress here, we didn't make enough progress here, what are we going to do differently? So someone has to play that honest broker role, which is, again, a big role of bringing the feedback into the system and reconvening them and assessing them. It's not enough to agree on the problem. You have to agree on where you are step by step. But again, you have to draw the poison from that. It can't be a finger pointing, Haskins, you screwed up. This is the last time we ever let you pour coffee. You know, you're gone. That's not helpful. It can't be good guys and bad guys. It's got to be, we tried it. We thought it would work. Didn't work. So what do we do differently? What do we try instead? So you need that too. You need to remove the impediments, and you need to bring in the feedback. But don't try to plan, because you can't. You're not that smart. None of us are.
Yeah, but what happens when there's good guys and bad guys?
I'm Vic DeLuca with the Jesse Smith Noise Foundation. We fund groups down in Appalachia that are trying to stop mountaintop removal of coal.
Right.
Coal industry says, you know, right, we don't even want to talk to you. We have the power.
Right.
We have the energy. We have everything. You don't even have standing. And your example in Bosnia, you gave all those people standing by bringing them in the room and treating them equal. This is not a situation there. Money and power and politics rules. So what do you do when you can't bring, because you don't have anybody who's able to bring those folks together, because the system is screwed up, whether it's the political system or the whole energy system. I mean, no one's looking at that part, but that's a real conflict, and it's a complex problem.
Well, I've fought in 5 wars. There are bad guys who try to stop you. You're exactly right, and that's why I made that my first point. Sometimes there are bad guys. They're not part of the solution, they're part of the problem. That's its own problem. It's really, in my mind, they're related, but one is, how do we neutralize them, how do we tip it so that it's at least a level playing field? How do we diminish them and increase us? And then, once we have that, what do we do with it? That's the problem that I was talking about. But I'm not trying to diminish that. You're exactly right. Sometimes there are bad guys. But we tend to always think in terms of right or wrong, good or bad. And very often that's not appropriate, and it gets in the way. And it stops us from reasoning together. Sometimes there are really people who want to kill the kids. I've seen that. Usually that's not the case. Usually it's people that could be somehow brought, if not willingly, but at least to not do harm in this situation. But if there are those people, that's a problem. You're not going anywhere. I mean, you're not going anywhere. You don't need to think that they're evil, but you do have to think that they got to be stopped. You have the microphone.
Just to follow up on what Vic was saying, because this whole system thinking focus I've really enjoyed, but it sounds as if what we're saying is that the way we approach problems and the way we think about problems and the way we design our engagement is kind of key to our success. But what Vic is saying, there's also an element of power, because you can have a great design and a great approach and a great analysis and really understand the problem, but you also need power.
Yes.
And power is a different problem.
Well,
And resources.
Sometimes you need power. Sometimes there's different kinds of
power.
Well,
you had a lot of money when you went into Bosnia. Sounds like that helped.
Well, I had money.
Yeah.
But, you know, the ladies in Northern Ireland had no power whatsoever. It's a group of mothers. They got the Nobel Peace Prize, but they leveraged shame and the sense of humanity. They had no power. They were the least powerful group in the country. But they worked together to begin to tilt the playing field. We've all seen this. I mean, Mother Teresa had no power other than moral suasion, which she then leveraged to start getting people to pay attention. So in the most abstract sense, yes, power is essential, but not. You gave a couple of great examples. It's like the smoking thing. I mean, what won that was changing the problem. Instead of everyone going against the tobacco industry and a question of science and all, they made it uncool. And that's what flipped it. When it became uncool to smoke, it was a tipping point. And it, because this was an emotional argument and evidence doesn't enter into it, all the evidence is on one side, it doesn't matter. You're not going to win against someone who's got a strong emotional and moral sense. So they just made it uncool. So, so yes and no, it's not that simple. Plans do have to be realistic. You can't plan on an all ice cream diet, 5 meals a day, and still lose weight. That ain't going to happen, right? But there's a lot of possibilities, and it doesn't have to be, I find a bigger bully than you to neutralize you. That is a tried and true approach. It works. Buy more congressmen than that guy did. But not always. And a lot of times, people find ways of working around that. So.
But Mother Teresa and the mothers in Northern Ireland built power.
Yes.
I mean, they didn't start with power, but they actually became powerful.
But
so
most
power
of you
can
are
be
too.
Built. So then that raises the question of how do you build power?
Right. I think we have a question. What time are we supposed to have?
I mean, I think our time's up, so we're kind of digging into your free time.
You're on break.
It's a,
last question.
A quick comment. In Deblyn L. from Van Buren Charitable Foundation in Rhode Island, I have found reading Ron Heifetz. Leadership, No Easy Answers is a great companion for systems thinking. He talks about the individual power that has to be brought in the, you know, building of teams and groups that can move the dial on complex issues. So yes. I think studying or reading yes. both helps with this end conversation.
Yes, I agree. That's a very good book. And I'm not a fan of leadership books. That's kind of like writing about food. It doesn't come across, but that is a very thought-provoking, very good book. I recommend it. Seriously, we're on your break now, I believe, so.
We're eating into that. Thank you guys very much. We appreciate it, this conversation.
This was cool.
It was fun. Thanks, man.